I want to welcome everyone back to our class. We are in the book of Job and starting in chapter 9 this week. Last week, we finished up chapter 8. Chapter 8 was Bildad's first reply to Job. And just to kind of recap some of the things we talked about last week, one way it's easy for me to remember very quickly what Eliphaz says versus what Bildad says, and we'll try to continue this theme going forward. Eliphaz makes the main point, or one of the main themes in his response to Job, is that man needs God because only God is good. Okay, so if you remember, Eliphaz really emphasizes this moral distance between God and man. And Bildad, very similarly, is emphasizing a distance between God and man as well. And the distance that he emphasizes is that God endures and man does not. So God, or man, needs God because only God can sustain. And some of the images that, when you're looking through chapter 8, that Bildad uses to make his points is he keeps going back to this idea of a plant. He first talks about these plants that try to grow in shallow water, and when that water's dried up, then they wither away. And emphasis being on, well, the plant should have recognized how much it needed the water before it tried to grow there, right? So such is the man who doesn't recognize that he needs God. He's like this plant trying to grow in shallow water. And then again, the idea of the plant trying to grow in this rocky soil, that when the plant starts trying to take root, it's going to start running into these rocks, and it's not going to be able to thrive, and ultimately it will die. So these are the images that Bildad uses to make his point. So Bildad, again, I think tries to bring it around at the end of his response to remind Job that I'm not your enemy here. He even brings a curse upon people who would be Job's enemies. He's not cursing himself. It's a way of saying, I'm not your enemy. I'm trying to help. So now we get into Job chapter 9. And it's interesting that what we're going to see right off the bat is Job's not actually going to address Bildad. He's actually going to go back and address Eliphaz again. So let's dig in. Let's start in verse 1. We'll read the first 12 verses and then try to work our way through. So Job chapter 9, verse 1. Then Job answered and said, "Truly I know that it is so, but how can a man be in the right before God? If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded? He who removes mountains, and they know it not, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place, and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun, and it does not rise, who seals up the stars, who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea, who made the Bear and Orion and the Pleiades and the chambers of the south," I think speaking of these constellations in the sky, "who does great things beyond searching out and marvelous things beyond number. Behold, he passes by me and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. Behold, he snatches away. Who can turn him back? Who will say to him, 'What are you doing?'" So again, right off the bat, if you look at verses 2 and 3, he says, "Truly I know that it is so, but how can a man be in the right before God?" That's going back to what Eliphaz was saying. If you go back to Job chapter 4 and verse 17, this is actually Eliphaz recounting this encounter he has with this shadowy figure that visits him at night. And in verse 17, this shadowy figure presents this same question to him. He says, "Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his Maker?" So Job is now addressing that idea here. Okay? And again, remember the point that Eliphaz was making is that man doesn't have the moral high ground when you compare him to God. So in verses 2 and 3, what Job is saying is kind of the same thing. It sounds like he's kind of agreeing with Eliphaz. Remember, look at it again in verse 2 and 3. He says, I know that it is so. And then he restates what Eliphaz says. How can a man be right before God. And then Job adds, if one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. So Job is, he's saying something very similar to what Eliphaz says, and he's agreeing with him in a sense. But I'm going to propose that Job is not agreeing with Eliphaz just for the sake of agreeing, but rather this is all part of his defense. Okay, so if you've ever been accused of anything, one way that you can address that accusation is by demonstrating you have a clear understanding of what your accuser is accusing you of. Right? You can say, okay, look, I know what you're saying. Right? You're saying it's this and this and this and this. I get it. There's no miscommunication here. I understand your accusation, but that's not me. Okay? And I think that's what Job is leading to. Okay? He's agreeing with Eliphaz's principle and then saying, I see what you're saying, but that's not what's going on here. Okay? And you can see some evidence in this, in these verses that we just read, because the examples that Job is giving here are of this hypothetical person who's kind of consistent with how his friends think Job's being. Right? In verse 3, he's talking about one who wishes to contend with God. Right? And to contend with God, you know, the idea there is like argue with or grapple with. Right? But Job doesn't want to contend with God. That's not consistent with the things Job has been saying. Job's actually been saying to this point, I concede. I give up. I don't want any of this. And you can go down to like verse 19. We'll just jump ahead a little bit. In verse 19 of Job chapter 9, Job says, if it is a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Job's saying, I'm not challenging him. I don't want to contend with God, okay? But such is the way of one who would want to contend with God. They could question him 1,000 times, or God could question him 1,000 times, and not once would the man be right in any of that exchange. And then in verse 4, you see some more evidence of this too. He says, he who is wise in heart and mighty in strength, speaking of God. Then he says, who has hardened himself against him and succeeded? So does Job believe that he himself is hardening himself against God? No, he doesn't think that, right? Because to harden yourself against someone would imply that you're trusting in your own strength, right? You're fortifying yourself and building yourself up and getting ready for the fight. But Job's like, I've got nothing left. I'm spent. And he even says that the words I'm speaking are like an empty wind. So he's not trusting in his own strength. So again, the point of this is I think Job is trying to say, look, I know the kind of person you're describing, and that's not me. And I see where that kind of person would run into trouble trying to speak to God. So, go ahead, John. It would just be speculation on my part. So if I had to speculate, I would say that I think that Job probably sees that he can kind of see where all of them are going and they're all in agreement. And I think he's going to try to attack this indictment against him the best way he can. So he's going to go back to this point that Eliphaz originally makes to try to show that he's not of the type of character that they're accusing him of. If you look at Bildad's statements in chapter 8, it's very much directed at Job's character as trusting in himself. And I think that kind of is responded to in this as well, but not directly. He actually goes back and uses something Eliphaz says to launch his arguments off of. just speculation. I don't know. It could be that Job was like, that's not even worth my attention, and goes back to Eliphaz. I don't know. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. That's human. That's human. And I'm not as quick on my feet as I'd like to be. You know, if I'm having a discussion with someone, if there's a disagreement over something, almost 100% of the time later on, I'll be like, oh, I wish I'd have said that, you know? Especially when you've lost it, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, good observations there. And that could very well be the case. It could just be like, now hold on. Let me go back to this because I just had a thought to add here. So, yeah, but it's interesting that, obviously he's addressing what Eliphaz says because he says he is. Right? He goes back to the same thing that Eliphaz stated. We're interpreting, or I'm interpreting what Job is saying in this chapter as making the greater point of, guys, it isn't what it looks like. Okay, this isn't what you think it is. I see it the way you're seeing it. So I understand what you're saying, but that's not what this is, okay? Now, as we get into chapter 10, probably next week, after saying these things in chapter 9 about how one could speak with God 1,000 times and not be able to answer correctly once, in Job chapter 10, Job's going to express a desire to speak with God. So I think that We'll think about that a little bit more as we go, but he's not confusing a desire to speak with God as wanting to argue with God or contend with God. And I think that's the distinction that Job makes in his own mind. I think Job believes, I should be able to go talk to God about this and speak with him without it being a contest of wills. I should be able to do that emptied, humbled, without any pretense, and just talk with him. And that doesn't have to mean I am challenging him. It doesn't have to mean that I'm hardening myself against him. All right. Verse 11, where he says, behold, he passes by me, and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. There's a little bit of irony here. I think Job is saying that, you know, when he's describing all these powerful attributes of God, that one of the things that God can do that he can't is God has access to him. God can see him. God could pass right in front of him and Job wouldn't even know it because God is that much more powerful and mysterious than he is. But it's kind of ironic to the reader, us, knowing that there's stuff happening on God's end that Job doesn't see. So it's like, in one sense, Job understands that God could pass by him and he wouldn't understand it. And in another sense, he doesn't understand, right? Because he doesn't get what's happening behind the scenes. So it's a little bit of irony there. And verse 12, he says, behold, he snatches away. Who can turn him back? Who will say to him, what are you doing? This idea of who can turn him back, it's speaking about who can stop God from taking something if he wants to take it. No one can stop him. And the person who says, what are you doing? They're doing that with the idea of making the other person kind of come to their senses and repent. Like, what are you doing? Wake up. You shouldn't be doing that. Like, that's the idea. Job is saying, who can say that to God? Who can say to God, what are you doing? Because God knows what he's doing. So who can say that to God? It's a rhetorical question. Nobody can. There's no one who's able to reprimand God because there's nobody higher than God. God is the highest authority that exists. And Job's going to keep hitting that as we go through chapter 9 as well. And that's going to lead to some difficult and potentially problematic philosophy as we consider this through some of Job's arguments. And I'm going to try to navigate this as best I can, but I was confessing to Rod a few minutes ago. As of about 8:45 this morning, I was still working on this. So it's a little treacherous. It can be treacherous. So we'll proceed with caution. And if I say something wrong, then let me know. Let's keep going. Verse 13. Again, I'm reading from the ESV. Verse 13. God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him bowed the helpers of Rahab. What in the world does that mean? Well, the ESV translates Rahab as a proper name, like the Rahab we know from the Old Testament. And that doesn't really make sense to me to translate that as a proper name. Now, if you don't translate it as a proper name, the word Rahab in Hebrew means pride or proud. So if we don't interpret it as a proper name, then the passage would read something like how the idea Rahab is modifying the term helpers. So in other words, proud, mighty helpers is the idea. And for whatever it's worth, that's how the King James and the New King James translate it. They don't translate the proper noun. They translate it as proud. So then the idea, the passage, or the meaning of the passage would be something like, even the most capable helpers that a man could find would be no match for God. Because even they bow to him. And that's consistent with the rest of what Job is saying, right? He's saying, who can I turn to? Even the best, most capable, proud, you know, strong warriors and helpers I might be able to rouse up and find, you know, at the end of the day, they kneel, they bow to God. They're not even wanting to get into a contest of wills with him. They submit to him. So, before we get into verse 14, the next section I want to read is kind of verses 14 through 21. But I want to pause for a moment, and we're going to take a step back, and we're going to try to remember the big picture of what's happening here as we go. Because again, this is where things can get treacherous. The rest of chapter 9 and chapter 10 can be difficult to understand, I think, if you're not keeping in mind the broader context of what's going on. There's lots of nuances here that we have to be careful of too, because we have to be mindful that we can't just read what Job's saying and say amen. There's a lot of things that Job is saying that are profound, even in this passage, but they've already been modified a bit when Job even speaks of himself as saying the speech of a despairing man is wind. So how much of what he's saying should we kind of take to the bank versus how much do we look at skeptically? And that's tricky. That's pretty tricky to do. Well, we're going to try to do the best we can here. And I think what helps me try to frame that is let's step back. Let's look at the big picture. Okay? Job's main point in this chapter is to try to show that how he's not guilty of what his friends are accusing him of. Keep that in mind as we're reading this. Job's making a defense of his character. Okay, so the things he's saying are going to lend themselves to a conclusion of, therefore, it's not my fault. It's not what you think it is. Okay, that's the bigger context. So keep in mind that all these things that Job is saying, he's doing so to defend his honor, defend his character, and to try to convince his friends that they don't have a right to accuse him of the things that they think he's guilty of. All right? Now, the point about how there's no one to help him that we just read about, even the greatest helpers bow to God, that's given in the context of Job acknowledging Eliphaz's argument that there's no one greater than God. So Job is about now to take the next logical step, which is, if no one is greater than God, and if I've done nothing wrong to provoke him or deserve this, then God is responsible for this. That's the next logical step that Job is about to take. Okay? If no one's higher than God, and if I didn't do anything to deserve this, then God's responsible for what's happening right now. That's going to be Job's next step that he takes. And this is where things can get treacherous for us. right? We can already kind of see how. Because I want to make sure that we're thinking about what is Job saying correctly, what is he saying incorrectly, and what is he not trying to say. Job is saying that God is the reason I am suffering. It's not because of anything I've done. And is he right? He is. He's right. He didn't do anything wrong. He's not suffering because he did anything wrong. God's doing this. God's allowing this to happen. Okay? Job is not saying everything bad that ever happens is God's fault. And we know Job is not saying that because Job holds this hypothetical person as accountable for hardening themselves against God and the one who would contend with God. They're still responsible for making those foolish decisions. So Job sees that. He's not saying that everything bad that happens is God's fault. And Job is not saying, God made me the way I am, therefore anything I do or think is just being consistent with how God made me. In other words, Job is not trying to remove accountability from himself in a total sense. And he's not making an argument for any of us who would try to come to the book of Job trying to understand the nature of ourselves versus the nature of God and trying to convince us that, you know what? It's really God's fault. It's not your fault. It's God. Like, Job's not trying to do that. Okay? This is a very specific circumstance. It's very unique in many ways. And in this unique circumstance, God is responsible for what's happening. It's not Job's fault. Okay, but Job is not trying to wholeheartedly discredit the idea of someone being accountable for their actions. That's not what Job is saying. So there's a fine line to walk here between Job correctly identifying God as the cause of the suffering versus denying his own personal accountability. Okay, we gotta make sure we understand the difference between those things. Now, to make things even trickier, let's take it another step. We have to take some of what Job says with a grain of salt. Because again, like we said, Job is suffering right now. How well do we think and reason through things when we're physically suffering? I'll admit I don't. I've never, and I hope I never will, had to go through anything remotely close to what Job is going through. But you give me a fever of 101 degrees, and suddenly my disposition on life is completely bleak. I mean, when we're suffering physically, it's hard to think straight. It's hard to get your attitude and your mind right. So we have to take some of what Job is saying with a grain of salt. And one thing I love about Job is he seems to be self-aware of that, because he's even said, he's used it to indict his friends. He said, you know what? What I'm saying right now probably doesn't even make any sense. So what does that say about you? That you would try to convince a man who's suffering like me and try to engage me in what I'm saying in argument. That just proves that you guys are out to win an argument. But he even uses that against them. Kyle?
Are you saying that when you feel that way, sick, that you don't think straight, or you just think differently?
Both. Because I'd like to think when I'm feeling well, I do think straight.
Because if we are going through a difficult time, maybe the things that are the most important to us, maybe getting out of that situation, become forefront. However, I don't know if I could suggest that that's a incorrect or the wrong way of thinking, so much as it is in that present circumstance, certain things become more important or more relevant. And therefore, when he's suffering, what's coming to the forefront of his mind may be even a better way to think about Job, at least at this point.
Yeah. I won't impose that on everybody else. I can only speak for myself. But when I'm not feeling well, it just affects my disposition. It's not that my focus changes and my priorities are changed. It's that I just don't want to deal with stuff. Yeah, John?
Have these emotions.
work against your rationale sometimes, oftentimes. I think that's kind of the heart behind the statement that's made in Jeremiah, wherever I came from, wherever the talking about man's heart. But when you do involve the emotions, things tend to be a little less clear. But at the same time, Kyle, I think you're on something for sure. Sometimes it does have to be the effect of bringing out what's really more important sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think we're supposed to be grappling with all of this.
Yeah.
We're doing what we're supposed to do.
Well, and to those points, you know, in no way hold me as the standard of how to act when you're sick, okay? who said that? She's not allowed to talk in this class. Yes? Yeah, I think that's a good way of bringing it together, and I agree with you on that. And, you know, just the fact that, like, he hasn't slept. Right? He's not even able to sleep. I mean, how well do we function when we're not sleeping? I mean, even if we just miss, like, one night of sleep, I feel like I've been robbed of something. And he hasn't slept in I don't know how many days. So let's keep all that in mind, okay? All the things we have to kind of hold in mind as we go. Job is ultimately making a defense, okay? So the things he's saying are going to serve his defense of his own character. And also, some of the things that he's saying aren't going to be right. They're things that I absolutely cannot get behind. And we'll look at some of those in a moment. One of such things we're about to look at is Job's going to say that God doesn't see a difference between the blameless and the wicked. In fact, according to Job, God destroys them both. I can't get behind that. I think that's the kind of stuff that when Job repents at the end of the book, he's repenting of stuff like this. Now, does this mean he's in rebellion to God? I don't think so. I think he's stumbling in what he says and what he thinks because he's suffering. Okay, but I don't think he's saying that correctly at all. All right. Let's keep going. We've got about 10 minutes left, so let's get through verse 21, and then we'll probably pick up again next week. Back up to verse 13. God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him bowed the helpers of Rahab. How then can I answer him, choosing my words with him? Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe my life. So in verses 14 and again in verses 20, let's just look at them again. In verse 14, he says, how then can I answer him, choosing my words with him? Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. And then in verse 20 again, though I am in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. So how is it, or what does Job mean when he says that even though he is in the right, he would basically still be wrong? Because, I mean, nobody's appealing for mercy if they're right, right? You appeal for mercy when you're condemned, when you've done something wrong and you can't fix it. So how can it be both? Yeah, Kyle?
Maybe it's his way of saying, I thought myself to be righteous, however these things happen, so maybe I am not.
Maybe so, but to me, he seems pretty forcefully stating that he's blameless. So it's difficult. Yeah, John? I think that, so the way I read it is, I think Job has absolutely considered that angle. And I think the conclusion that he's arrived at, and we're going to see this again in chapter 10, is if he's done something wrong that he doesn't realize, why won't God tell him what it is so he can fix it? So he acknowledges that's a possibility, but without getting any feedback on what he's done wrong, what can he do about it? You know, God seems content to just let him suffer. And that doesn't seem fair to Job. I'll offer what I think is going on here. I think what Job is doing is he's speculating a little bit on the nature of right and wrong. I think that he's arguing when he says that he's in the right or that he's innocent, he's affirming a belief that there is an objective standard of right and wrong. That he can say, yes, it's not in question, I'm innocent. God doesn't seem to find me innocent, but I'm innocent. And there you start to have the disconnect between objective right and wrong and God's judgments of right and wrong. So I think Job is making a distinction there. He's saying, objectively speaking, I'm right. But according to God, I'm not. If there is an objective standard of right and wrong, then even God, as wise as he is, he can at least plausibly rethink some conclusion that he's reached or some judgment that he's reached. But if all we have to contend with is the fact that God judges and no one else is more powerful to overrule him, then we're kind of at the mercy of whatever he thinks and whatever he wants. And again, this is treacherous, right? This is tricky stuff to try to navigate. These are tricky philosophical points. But that's going to be the next step down this philosophical path that Job is taking. He's going to argue, if no one's more powerful than God, then nobody can challenge his judgments on what's right and wrong. Even if they aren't objectively correct. No one's able to challenge him. Yes? Yeah, and one of the there's something beautiful happening here too.
And one of the things I'll keep saying over and over again is one of the things I love about the book of Job is that topics like this are not off limits. And it's not just the book of Job. It's the Bible in general. You know, we explore these difficult things that happen and we grapple with these struggles that we have with doubt and the nature of right and wrong in our relationship with God. And what's he doing? And why won't he just answer me? We wrestle with these things. And you know what? We have something we can go to and see that that's already in the Bible. People have wrestled with these things for thousands of years. It's not off limits for us to study. Yeah, Kelton? Well, I will say that's certainly how his friends are going to perceive what he's saying. And I think Job's stopping a little bit short of that. But I think that he's arguing for if God is the most powerful being in existence, then what he says goes, whether it seems right or wrong to me. And I think what Job's still holding on to, though, is that there is this objective standard of right and wrong. And Job can go to that and he can say, I am blameless. I haven't done anything wrong. But that's not what God sees. And what am I to do about that? I think that's what's going on. But I don't know that he's accusing God or he's ready to accuse God directly. I still see him kind of working through these things. And the reason I stop short of believing he's accusing God, even in just the text, he still speaks at the end of this chapter about being terrified of what it would be like to speak with God. He still fears God. He doesn't want to contend with God. But he's trying to make sense of this, right? So this is one way that it makes sense to him. So we've only got a couple minutes, and I want to kind of get through these thoughts, and we'll have to pick up again next week. But again, the next step he's going to take down his philosophical journey is there's no one more powerful than God, or if there's no one more powerful than God, then no one can challenge his judgments on what's right and wrong. And let's jump down to verses 31 to 32, or sorry, 32 and 33, where he's going to bring that point home. He says, "For he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hands on us both." So Job is very much talking about how there's no one higher than God that I can appeal to. I can't take God to court in front of some other judge because that judge is just going to bow down to God. Right? That's not going to work. So for all practical purposes, whether or not Job is blameless by some objective standard of right and wrong, it becomes irrelevant because of God's own power to enforce what God believes is right and true. That's where I think Job is in his thinking. So whatever God says goes, according to Job, even if it isn't, quote unquote, objectively right. Okay? And that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate if you're in Job's place, right? Because Job happens to disagree with God about how much Job should suffer. So that's a little bit unfortunate for him. But again, what authority can Job stand on that isn't already lower than God? So even more troubling to someone like Job who might be thinking this is that means God can suddenly redefine right and wrong and there's nobody to hold him accountable to that. That's the next step down that path. If God's judgment is the ultimate standard, then God can change. And who can challenge him on that? If God decides it's time for you to suffer, Job, who's going to tell God he can't do that? Who's going to go to God, like Job says, and says, what are you doing? No one can do that. There's no one with the power to do that. So, I mean, these ideas are present. I mean, we looked at it in verse 12. You know, who will say to him, what are you doing? In verse 16, if I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice, because who is Job to try to tell God what to do? In verse 17, he says, he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. Again, going back to, he doesn't have a quote-unquote objective right to do this, but he's doing it anyway. So, unfortunately, we're going to have to pause there. We're going to bring this back around even more when we get into verses 22 and following. Think about the conclusions that Job is reaching, and we'll just read it real quick. Job says, "It is all one, therefore I say he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not, then he, then who is it?" That's problematic theology right there. Okay? This is the danger of being on a logical path. You're deducing things. If A leads to B, then B leads to C, then C leads to D, and D leads to E. But now, what kind of God are we at? What kind of God have we arrived at? This isn't the kind of God that we would want to serve. And I'm going to argue, too, we're going to bring it back around and show how throughout the book of Job, there's this bigger experiment to show that God is not just right because he's powerful, but God is intrinsically good. And there is goodness that he is after, that he wants us to demonstrate. And how he talks about how when he says, "My power is perfected in weakness," this weakness has a way of proving our character. God isn't right just because he's the strongest. I would argue it's the opposite. God is the strongest because he's the best. Because he is intrinsically good. And I think that that's a theme we're going to look at more, Lord willing, in our next class. Sorry I didn't get to everybody, but thank you for your comments and your time.